Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Sutter of the Democratic World Federalist and member of the International Relations Member-Led Forum, and your chair for tonight. We welcome any viewers or listeners and invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Today, speaking on continuity of government, is the state of emergency superseding our Constitution, is Peter Dale Scott, a former Canadian diplomat and professor of English at the University of California, Berkeley. He is a political poet and in 2002 received the Lannan Poetry Award. Among his poetry volumes are Coming to Jakarta, a poem about terror, Minding the Darkness, a poem for the year 2000, and a ballad of drugs and 9/11. At the same time, as a researcher and writer of prose, he wrote books focused on war, covert operations, the politics of crime, and the international drug traffic. His investigative books include Drugs, Oil, and War, The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America, The American War Machine, Deep Politics, the CIA, Global Drug Connection, and The Road to Afghanistan. What a long subtitle there. In 2006, I had the honor of introducing Professor David Ray Griffin at the Commonwealth Club. As you know, he's the dean of the 9/11 scholars. In 2007, he and Peter Dale Scott wrote chapters for and edited the book 9/11 and American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out. 9/11 was bookended between the continuity of government plan before it and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the Patriot Act at home that followed it. Something is known of 9/11. Much is known of the machinations that got the United States into the wars. But little is known of the continuity of government plan. To enlighten us, we have Professor Scott. Following the presentation, he'll take questions from the audience. Without further ado, let's welcome Peter Dale Scott.
Well, I'd like to pick up from what John Sutter just said, that you don't hear much in the papers about continuity of government. It's in that category of things which are so important that our media can't talk about them. And I hope tonight to persuade you that it really is important. First, however, I'd like to thank John for arranging this evening, and I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for hosting it. Can you hear me in the back? Is all going well? And without further ado, I will try and make my case that COG is something whose absence of profile is one symptom of just how serious it is. In July 1987, during the Iran-Contra hearings grilling of Oliver North, the American public got a glimpse and no more of one of North's most controversial activities. Ostensibly, North had been handling emergency plans to deal with a nuclear attack, which is a legitimate concern, but press accounts alleged that the planning was for a more generalized suspension of the Constitution at the president's determination. As part of its routine Iran-Contra coverage, the following exchange was printed in the New York Times, but without any comment or follow-up. This is a quote now from the hearings. Congressman Jack Brooks, Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster? Now, this is me. Both North's attorney and Senator Daniel Inouye, the Democratic chair of the committee, responded in a way that showed they were aware of the issue. And here again is the hearing text. Brendan Sullivan, North's counsel, agitatedly, "Mr. Chairman," Senator Inouye, "I believe that question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch upon that." Congressman Brooks, "I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency, that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it, and I wondered if that was an area in which he had worked. I believe that it was, and I wanted to get a confirmation." And then Inouye, "May I most respectfully request that this matter not be touched upon at this stage. If we wish to get into this, I'm certain arrangements can be made for an executive session." End of quote. Now, Brooks was responding to a story by Alfonso Chardy in the Miami Herald about Oliver North's involvement with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, in planning for continuity of government, COG. Thank God I can say COG from that one. According to Chardy, the plans envisage, quote, "suspension of the Constitution, turning control of the government over to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, emergency appointment of military commanders to run state and local governments, and declaration of martial law during a national crisis," quote, end quote. Reagan had installed at FEMA a counterinsurgency team that he had already assembled as governor of California. The team was headed by Army Colonel Louis Jufrida, who had attracted Reagan's attention by a paper he had written while at the U.S. Army College advocating the forcible, warrantless detention of millions of black Americans in concentration camps. This recommended him to Reagan. Reagan first installed Jufrida as head of the California National Guard and then called on him to, this is a quote now, "to design Operation Cable Splicer, martial law plans to legitimize the arrest and detention of anti-Vietnam War activists and other political dissidents," unquote. These plans were refined with the assistance of British counterinsurgency expert Sir Robert Thompson, who had used massive detentions and deportations to deal with the 1950s communist insurgency in what is now Malaysia. At the time, few people, including myself, attached much importance to the Chardy story about COG. Chardy himself suggested that the Reagan's Attorney General, William French Smith, had intervened to stop the COG plan from being presented to the president. And in 1955, Jufrida was forced out of office for having spent government money to build a private residence. But COG planning not only continued, it expanded. 7 years later, in 1994, Tim Weiner reported in the New York Times that what he called the Doomsday Project, the search for, quote, "ways to keep the government running after a sustained nuclear attack on Washington," had less than 6 months to live. Weiner's language was technically correct, but also very misleading. Because, in fact, COG planning now simply continued with a new target, terrorism. On the basis of Weiner's article, the first two books to discuss COG planning by James Bamford and James Mann both reported that COG planning had been abandoned. Recently, Tim Shorrock repeated that the COG program was abandoned during the Clinton administration. And Shirley Ann Warshaw in 2009 wrote that the Clinton administration shut down the super secret project. But on this narrow point, all these otherwise excellent and well-informed authors were wrong. What Weiner and these authors did not report was that in the final months of Reagan's presidency, the purpose of COG planning had officially changed. It was no longer for arrangements after a nuclear war, but for, quote, any national security emergency. This was defined in Executive Order 12656 of 1988 as, quote, any occurrence, including natural disaster, military attack, technological emergency, or other emergency that seriously degrades or seriously threatens the national security of the United States, close quote. In this way, a totally legitimate program dating back to Eisenhower of planning extraordinary emergency measures for an America devastated and decapitated in a nuclear attack was now converted to confer equivalent secret powers on the White House for anything it considered an emergency. This expanded application of COG was apparently envisaged as early as 1984, when, according to Boston Globe reporter Ross Gelbspan, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North was working with officials of FEMA to draw up a secret contingency plan to surveil political dissenters and to arrange for the detention of hundreds of thousands of undocumented aliens in case of an unspecified national emergency. The plan, part of which was codenamed Rex 84, called for the suspension of the Constitution under a number of scenarios, including a U.S. invasion of Nicaragua. Not, you notice, a Nicaraguan invasion of America, but an American invasion of Nicaragua, such as we have seen since in the case of Afghanistan. In other words, extreme measures designed originally to deal with an externally directed and devastating nuclear attack were being secretly modified by a non-governmental group to deal with domestic dissenters, the situation that pertains today. Now, clearly, 9/11 met the conditions for the new conditions for the imposition of COG measures, and we know for certain that COG planning was implemented on that day in 2001 before the last plane had crashed in Pennsylvania. I have to stress this because two reviews of my last book thought I was wrong on this point, but believe me, I'm not. The 9/11 report confirms this twice on pages 38 and 326. It was under the auspices of COG that Bush stayed out of Washington on that day, and that other government leaders like Paul Wolfowitz were swiftly evacuated to Site R inside a hollowed-out mountain near Camp David. But the imposition or the implementation of COG went beyond short-term responses to the installation of what Professor Shirley Ann Warshaw calls a 90-day alternative shadow government outside Washington. Here's a long quote from her book. Cheney jumped into action in his bunker beneath the East Wing to ensure continuity in government. He immediately began to create his shadow government by ordering 100 mid-level executive officials to move to specially designated underground bunkers and stay there 24 hours a day. They would not be rotated out, he informed them, for 90 days, since there was evidence, he hinted, that the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda, which had masterminded the attack, had nuclear weapons. The shadow government, as a result, needed to be ready to take over the government from the bunkers, close quote. Those 90 days saw the swift implementation of the key features attributed to COG planning by Gelbspan and Chardy in the 1980s, warrantless detentions, warrantless deportations, and the warrantless eavesdropping that is their logical counterpart. The clearest example was the Bush administration's Project Endgame, a 10-year plan initiated in September 2001 to expand detention camps at a cost of $400 million in fiscal year 2007 alone. This implemented the central feature of the massive detention exercise Rex 84, conducted by Louis Jafrida and Oliver North in 1984. There was also a flurry of other rapid moves to restructure America's external and domestic structures. Before I discuss some of them, I should acknowledge the obvious, that enhanced measures to deal with terrorism are needed, and that for some of them we should all be grateful. We should acknowledge also, however, that the most significant achievements against terrorism so far have been the result of traditional intelligence and police work. As for the war on terror, the most prominent achievement of Cheney's 90 days, many experts have asserted that it has created more terrorists than it has disposed of. On September 20, 2001, Bush launched the war on terror in a televised address to a joint session of Congress, when he said, "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." And I'll just interject to say that General Petraeus, in the new book, Obama's Wars, says that it will last for, just in Afghanistan alone, will last through our lifetime and our children's lifetime. Today, we now have about 100,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan to deal with an officially estimated 60 members of Al-Qaeda. The predictable result has been an expansion of terrorist activities into Somalia, Yemen, and above all, Pakistan. The war on terror was administratively implemented in three national security presidential directives, NSPDs 7, 8, and 9. All three are classified, and the topics of two of them are not even known. The third, NSPD of October 25, 2001, directed the Secretary of Defense to plan military options against both Taliban and Al-Qaeda targets in Afghanistan. But the October date is misleading. A version of the directive calling for covert action in Afghanistan had already been approved by principals on September 4, 2001, 1 week before 2011. An enhanced plan for military action in Afghanistan had been approved by Bush on September 17th, and the same document directed the Pentagon to begin planning military options for an invasion of Iraq. Perhaps the most significant domestic product from Cheney's, I call it trimester mirabilis, 90 days that produced so much, was the Patriot Act of October 25th, 2001. Congress was given only 1 week to pass this 340-page bill, which in the opinion of researchers was, just like the Tonkin Gulf Resolution in 1964, was already written and ready to go long before September 11th, close quote. In 2007, the Justice Department acknowledged that FBI agents had abused the Patriot Act more than 1,000 times. We should not forget, now this is sensitive, but I have to say this, we should not forget that the Patriot Act was only passed after lethal weapons-grade anthrax letters were mailed to two crucial Democratic senators, Senators Dashley and Leahy, who had initially challenged the bill. After the anthrax letters, however, they withdrew their initial opposition. Someone, we still do not know who, must have planned those anthrax letters well in advance. This is a fact most Americans do not want to think about. It is generally agreed that of the three men in national command authority on 9/11, Cheney was the ideologue most committed to restoring a presidency that had been weakened by Watergate. Cheney had already declared in his Iran-Contra Minority Report of 1987 his belief that, and this is quoting Cheney, the chief executive will on occasion feel duty-bound to assert monarchical notions of prerogative which will permit him to exceed the law. That's all Cheney. And as vice president, Cheney, along with Cheney's assistant, David Addington, and Cheney's appointee, John Yoo, established the legal apparatus for declaring that the president had the prerogative power to, quote, deploy military forces preemptively, close quote, and that the Geneva Conventions and other international agreements against torture, quote, do not protect members of the Al-Qaeda organization. Both those quotes are from John Yoo memos, but John Yoo was put there by Cheney. By Executive Order 813228 of October 8, 2001, the President established an Office of Homeland Security within the Presidential Executive Office. This has engendered, in turn, the Department of Homeland Security, now the third largest cabinet department, and also a series of Homeland Security presidential directives. For example, Homeland Security Presidential Directive 6, HSPD 6, of September 16, 2003, created a Terrorism Screening Center, TSC, to consolidate the government's approach to terrorism screening. Since then, we've become very used to repeated stories about nonviolent individuals who are prevented from boarding airplanes because their names are on TSC computers on either the no-fly list or the terrorist watch list. Senator Ted Kennedy testified in Congress that he had been repeatedly delayed at airports because a T. Kennedy was on the no-fly list. Until July 2008, Nelson Mandela was also on the list. CBC News reported in Canada in 2008 that, and this is a quote, a Quebec businessman whose name is on the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's flight passenger watch list has decided to change his name to avoid lengthy security hassles at the airport. In addition to the no-fly list, with 4,000 names in 2009 and 8,000 today, after a year of Obama, some people are prevented from flying because they are on the terrorist watch list, a much longer list which contained over 1 million names as of summer 2010. This is why Walter F. Murphy, a noted professor of constitutional law, was detained in 2007 on his journey to lecture, ironically, about his book Constitutional Democracy. According to Professor Murphy, this is all him now, he was asked by an airline employee, have you been on any peace marches? We ban a lot of people from flying because of that. I explained, said Murphy, that I had not so marched, but had, in September 2006, given a lecture at Princeton, televised and put on the web, highly critical of George Bush for his many violations of the Constitution. That'll do it, the man said. That's what the airline employee said. In the end, all these cases were resolved satisfactorily, but you risk permanent deportation if you have an Arabic-sounding name. The ACLU is suing on behalf of Ayman Latif, not just a U.S. citizen, but a disabled U.S. Marine veteran, who under Obama has been stranded in Egypt for months because on orders from the U.S. Embassy there, he has not been able to board a plane to come home. This is a real hardship case. Latif told NPR that, quote, because I missed my appointments in the U.S. to be evaluated as a disabled vet, now the VA administration is saying that they're going to cut my benefits from what they are now to zero, close quote. And on the same program, Stuart Baker, a former assistant secretary for policy with the Department of Homeland Security, vigorously defended the no-fly list. But when asked if there is any legal authority, by which the United States can say to a citizen who is abroad, you may not return to this country? Baker replied, I know of none. This did not seem to concern him. Ayman Lateef's case is far from unique. According to the New York Times, advocacy groups say they are trying to help Americans stranded in Yemen, Egypt, Colombia, and Croatia, among other countries. At least one American, Raymond Earl Knebel IV, not even an Arab, who studied in Yemen and is now in Colombia, was returned to Colombia by the Mexican authorities after he sought to cross the border into the United States, the groups say. Another post-9/11 innovation from the Jofrida Oliver North COG plans was the militarization of domestic U.S. law enforcement in 2002 under a new military command, NORTHCOM. Through NORTHCOM, the U.S. Army now is engaged with local enforcement in the surveillance and counterterrorism planning of America, in the same way that through CENTCOM, it is engaged with local enforcement to police Iraq. Of course, Army platoons do not patrol roads and break down the doors of homes as they do in Iraq or Afghanistan. But behind the scenes, in so-called fusion centers, the military, the FBI, state police, along with private intelligence corporations like SAIC, maintain and analyze data to identify potential threats to those in power. These fusion centers, quote, have been internally promoted by the U.S. Army as a means to avoid restrictions preventing the military from spying on the domestic population. In other words, administrative arrangements flowing from old COG plans have been used to circumvent the Posse Comitatus Acts on the statute books without repealing them. Finally, still in the 90-day shadow government period after 9/11, President Bush proclaimed two important emergencies that are still in force today. By law, an emergency is only supposed to last for a year, but they've been extended. One, on September 14th, 2001, Bush issued Proclamation 7463, Declaration of National Emergency by Reason of Certain Terrorist Attacks, together with Executive Order 13223, ordering the ready reserve of the armed forces to active duty. I'll come back to this proclamation because, as we'll see, its terms were significantly expanded when it was renewed in 2007. And then the second, on September 23rd, 2001, by Executive Order 13224, the President declared a national emergency with respect to persons who commit, threaten to commit, or support terrorism pursuant to the International Emergency Powers Act. This gave the President the power to confiscate, without trial or warning, the property of individuals providing funds to entities such as charitable foundations, which were judged to be supporting terrorism. This executive order initially blocked property of 27 designated terrorists, but the list had since become enormous. When I last looked at it 5 days ago, the list included 87 pages just for the letter A. A lawsuit has been instituted asserting that the designation of alleged terrorists was arbitrary, and a lower court initially agreed that the president's designation authority is unconstitutionally vague, but this case is still under appeal. From its beginning in 1982, two of the key planners on the secret COG planning committee were Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, the same two men who implemented COG on 9/11. The committee had been established by Reagan under a secret executive order in 1982. Despite what Weiner implied, the committee continued to meet without interruption until the George W. Bush presidency in 2001. Thus, Cheney and Rumsfeld continued their secret planning when Clinton was president, even after both men, both Republicans, were by that time heads of major corporations and not in the government at all. Moreover, Andrew Coburn claims that the Clinton administration, according to a Pentagon source, had no idea what was going on. This is a long quote from Andrew Coburn's biography of Rumsfeld. Although the exercises continued, still budgeted at over $200 million a year in the Clinton era, the vanished Soviets were now replaced by terrorists. There were other changes, too. In earlier times, the specialists selected to run the shadow government had been drawn from across the political spectrum, Democrats and Republicans alike. But now, down in the bunkers, Rumsfeld found himself in politically congenial company, the players' roster being filled almost exclusively with Republican hawks. This is a quote from a Pentagon official. You could say this was a secret government in waiting. The Clinton administration was extraordinarily inattentive. They had no idea what was going on, close quote. Coburn's account requires some qualification. Richard Clark, a Clinton Democrat, makes it clear that he participated in the COG games in the 1990s and indeed drafted Clinton's presidential decision directive, PDD 67, on enduring constitutional government and continuity of government. But COG planning involved different teams for different purposes, and I suspect that the Pentagon official was describing the Department of Defense team, which was dealing with military retaliation. There is no way to determine how many of the constitutional changes since 9/11 can be traced directly back to COG planning. However, we do know that COG planning was still active in 2007 when President Bush issued National Security Presidential Directive 51, NSPD 51, which was also HSPD 20. This directive set out what FEMA later called, quote, a new vision to ensure the continuity of our government, close quote, and it was followed in August by a new National Continuity Policy Implementation Plan. NSPD 51 also nullified PDD 67, Richard Clark's COG directive of a decade earlier, and it referred to, quote, new classified continuity annexes, close quote, which shall, quote, be protected from unauthorized disclosure. Under pressure from his 9/11 truth constituents, Congressman Peter DeFazio of the Homeland Security Committee twice requested to see these classified continuity annexes. His request was denied. DeFazio requested a second time in a letter signed by the chair of his committee. The request was denied again. Now, I mentioned earlier that the proclamation of a national emergency issued by Bush on September 14, 2001, and since renewed annually to this day, changed significantly in 2007. All previous annual renewals had enumerated the emergency measures that were being renewed. For example, quote, the measures taken on September 14, 2001, November 16, 2001, and January 16, 2002. But after Bush issued NSPD 51 of 2007, with its new vision and its new classified COG annexes, the next renewal of the emergency proclamation replaced the previous specific enumerations with a more sweeping general sentence, and this is a quote. Because the terrorist threat continues, the national emergency declared on September 14, 2001, last extended on September 5, 2006, and the powers and authorities adopted to deal with that emergency must continue in effect beyond September 14, 2007. I say it again, the powers and authorities adopted to deal with that emergency. This language is so vague, it is hard to see how it could not cover the classified continuity annexes of NSPD 51 as well. If so, the public proclamation was now proclaiming the continuation of a new secret denied to Congress. The two renewals of the emergency by Barack Obama do not repeat this specific language from 2007, but likewise they fail to enumerate just what powers are being extended. The National Emergencies Act, one of the post-Watergate reforms that Vice President Cheney so detested, specifies that, and this is a quote from the statute books, not later than 6 months after a national emergency is declared, and not later than the end of each six-month period thereafter that such emergency continues, each House of Congress shall meet to consider a vote on a joint resolution to determine whether that emergency shall be terminated. The law does not permit Congress to review an emergency. It requires Congress to do it. To review it. Yet in 9 years, Congress has not once met to discuss the state of emergency declared by George W. Bush in response to 9/11, a state of emergency that remains in effect today. Appeals to the Congress to meet its responsibilities have fallen on deaf ears, even now that the Congress is dominated or was dominated by Democrats. Former Congressman Dan Hamburg and I appealed publicly in 2009 both to President Obama to terminate the emergency and to Congress to hold the hearings required of them by statute. But Obama, without discussion, extended the 9/11 emergency again in September 2009 and again in September 2010. Meanwhile, Congress has continued to ignore its statutory obligations. One congressman explained to a constituent that the provisions of the National Emergencies Act have now been rendered inoperative by COG. If true, this would indicate that the constitutional system of checks and balances no longer applies and that secret decrees now override public legislation. Understandably, many people tend to repress the extraordinary facts that Cheney and Rumsfeld were able, one, to help plan successfully for constitution modifications when not even in the government, and two, implement these same changes themselves when back in power. The first of these facts gives us a glimpse of an unacknowledged, ongoing power realm independent of the publicly acknowledged state. In the words of James Mann, quote, Cheney and Rumsfeld were, in a sense, a part of the permanent, though hidden, national security apparatus of the United States, inhabitants of a world in which presidents come and go, but America always keeps on fighting. A CNN special assignment assessment of the COG planners was even more dramatic. And they said, quote, in the United States of America, there is a hidden government about which you know nothing. Or I should say here, we know nothing. What is the first step out of this current state of affairs in which the Constitution appears to have been superseded by a higher, if less legitimate, authority? I submit that it is to get Congress to do what the law requires and determine whether our present proclamation of emergency, quote, shall be terminated, close quote. As part of this procedure, Congress should find whether secret COG powers never submitted to Congress or seen by it are among the powers and authorities which Bush in 2007 included in his prolongation of the 2001 emergency. This is not a technical or procedural detail. It is a test of whether the United States continues to be governed by its laws and constitution, or whether, as has been alleged, the laws and constitution have now in places been superseded. Last sentence. And hopefully Congress would look at the activities of Cheney's 90 days of COG shadow government in 2001 and their relationship to the genesis of the Patriot Act, the 10-year program for detention camps, and the permanent militarization of U.S. domestic law enforcement. Thank you very much.
Well, our thanks to Professor Scott for his talk on continuity of government. Is the state of emergency superseding our Constitution? And it seems to be. We'd like to remind our audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Sutter of the International Relations Forum and your chair for today. Dr. Scott will now take questions. And if anyone has one, raise your hand and we'll pass around the microphone. But as the moderator, may I ask the first question? I have a notice that another member of the Bush family, Jeb, who was active in the Project for the American Century, as many of these others were, and was governor of Florida, on the 7th of September 2001, declared martial law. How does that relate to COG?
Well, I'm in the usual position. I'm in talking about something I don't know anything about. But did he give a reason why he declared martial law? You remember that September 4th, they had already approved a plan to go in and oust the Taliban from Afghanistan. So he didn't have to know anything about what was going to happen on 9/11, but he probably did know that the government was gearing up for a new phase in dealing with the Afghan problem.
Well, he was federalizing the Florida National Guard as a unit of the Army, among other things.
That's the whole topic I thought of talking about. You know, the Bush people wanted very much to federalize permanently the National Guard, and some people think that FEMA screwed up so royally on Katrina to give Bush an argument. He did use it as an argument that we should just put all of this in the hands of the U.S. Army. And of course, it's conspicuous, no secret, that Bush's, especially in his second semester, in his second term, if there was a disaster, he brought in the Army. He was accustoming us to this. So you remember there were forest fires in Southern California. I think the year was 2007. And Bush arrived and said, "You have nothing to worry about. I have the head of NORTHCOM here with me, and he will be able to deal with it." There was great resistance from the governors of the states, including the Republican governors, to allowing the National Guards to become part of the permanent federal thing. I would like to know more about this. I intend to follow up on your question. I mean, as a statement, it's a very important statement, and I'm sorry that I can't add much to it. David, do you want to?
I have a question. One thing you didn't know, first of all, or you didn't mention, was that when Chertoff became the Secretary of Homeland Security, national preparedness in FEMA, which was the preparedness division housing COG, was taken into Homeland Security. It was replaced in FEMA with the act in September 06 when they put it back in. But Chertoff was trying to decimate FEMA at that time. My question, I have a two-part sort of question. You didn't mention anything about the Bilderberg Group, and I was wondering if Cheney and Rove and Rumsfeld and these people that are part of the Grove up north are also part of Bilderberg Group, and I think Obama's part of it too. What do they have to do with a secret government, since you mentioned the private sector? And when we were being attacked on all fronts by 15 Saudis on September 11th, and we don't know why we're going into Iraq for that, or some of us don't. What would you do when we knew that the Al-Qaeda and was going to be attacking the United States, and as Condoleezza Rice had said in one of her hearings, we knew in August, but should we shut down the whole airlines in order to stop the Al-Qaeda from attacking by air? What would you do if you don't want a continuity of government, a line of succession, something like martial law when we're being attacked, anthrax, computer viruses, bombs, airplanes?
We were attacked by anthrax, which came from a government bio-war laboratory in the state of Maryland. There's no doubt about that. Oh, it absolutely was proven. And, in fact, the FBI had only two suspects, and both of them were connected with that lab. And at the time, there was a lot of talk about it was Iraq. All of this, Bush himself in his speech to the Congress in January of 2003 said how Iraq had enough yeast to produce 26,000 liters of weapons-grade anthrax. We know from that precise number that he was drawing on a report from Richard Butler, who is, I have to say, sort of in cahoots with these PNAC people who so urgently wanted us to invade Iraq. There are still one or two people who say that the hijackers and Atta in particular were connected with Iraq. Cheney still says that. I think James Woolsey still says it. Jinsa, PNAC people say it. It's not true. And the 9/11 Commission report said it's not true. And with the anthrax, I can't pull out who has proved it. But you can trace weapons-grade anthrax and find out where it comes from, and there's no doubt whatsoever it came from U.S. Army labs. So I hate to be so emphatic about that. Now, you asked me what I would do. I think I said in my talk, yes, we have to be vigilant. I think that that the best response that we've seen to the problem of terrorism has come from the things we always did do, intelligence, police work. You get into a very dangerous area, the use of double agents, which I think probably is justified but also leads to disasters. It was a U.S. double agent who trained the people who were responsible for the first World Trade Center bombing. And the same man, Ali Mohammed, I have a whole chapter about him in The Road to 9/11, and I think every American ought to know about Ali Mohammed, because here is a man who was actually detained by the RCMP doing their police work in Canada, and he gave the RCMP a number, a telephone number. He said, phone this number. And they did. It was a number. It was the number of the San Francisco FBI. They released Ali Mohammed, and he then went to Kenya. And according to everybody, including the 9/11 report, directed the surveillance for the bombing of the U.S. embassy in Kenya. Well, you might say every now and then something goes wrong, but then in 2007 we had a bombing in Mumbai. And the New York Times revealed just this month that the man who did the surveillance there, this man Headley, who has also a Pakistani name, he's a Pakistani-American, he was sent to India by the DEA to investigate drug smuggling there. So I think we should be very, very cautious about these sort of exotic uses of double agents who then provide the justification for invoking all these COG measures. Keep with traditional intelligence and police work. And above all, martial law is a response to a military crisis. It's not a military crisis if we're going to invade Nicaragua. It's a military crisis when Nicaragua is going to invade us. But that's not what they were contemplating. So that's why I'm so head up about this. Now, your other question, we could talk for an hour, but you asked about the Bilderbergers. In both my last two books, I've suggested that back in the 70s, there was a very major power struggle at the top levels of the American society between the internationalists who wanted America to go back to being a great trading power and the militarists who felt that America had to focus primarily on preserving its military dominance over every other country, including its allies. And that was, I have a whole chapter about this. And Cheney and Rumsfeld are key figures in that chapter because at that time they were both in Ford's White House staff. Rumsfeld was the first chief of staff National Security Advisor. And then Cheney replaced him. But the reason I'm going into all this is because, by and large, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergs, the Trilateral Commission, all those people were, not all of them, but most of them, the bulk of them tended to be the internationalists. And PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, which is Woolsey and Cheney and Rumsfeld, who feel that America has to assert its military might, supported by a lot of oil companies are on both sides because they want U.S. troops in Asia to make sure that the government of Kazakhstan will allow them to pull the oil that they've paid for out of Kazakhstan. But it gets more complicated and fuzzy, and I think I'd better stop there. Did you have a question?
Yeah, you spoke about how governments, presidencies come and go, but the so-called permanent government remains permanent. But, of course, in the Bush years, George W. Bush, the two were rather intertwined because of Cheney's centrality to that presidency. You talked about how Clinton, though, it seems on the evidence of what you said tonight, remained fairly oblivious to the COG apparatus. Mm-hmm. But from what you've said tonight, it seems that the Obama administration, much to the dismay of those Democrats and progressives who supported him, it seems to be much more complicit, almost actively complicit, with many of the measures undertaken by the COG. How aware do you think President Obama is, based on the evidence you've seen, of this shadow government? And he, obviously many of his policies seem to be in line with theirs, but to what extent is he at odds with them, and to what extent is he his own man?
Well, I think we will know much more about this in July of 2011. Because Obama, I've read Obama's Wars by Bob Woodward, and it's a good read, by the way, and I think it is dealing with an important topic, which is, I'd say the big thing that is changing incrementally with each presidency is the what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex has been growing and growing and growing and becoming more, not only more and more powerful, but also more and more wealthy, to the extent that when he was talking about it, it was a problem sort of on the horizon, or maybe already inside, but the America was basically, he believed and hoped, stronger than this military-industrial complex. Since then, it has become, I think we have to say, the financial petroleum military industrial complex. And I talk about this in both my books. And it has become huge, so that, most of the productive industries that we have now are, whether it's electronics or avionics or whatever, they're the industries which are defense-related. And we have seen what we call the financialization of America, which is part of this problem. But the financial basis, those firms like Goldman Sachs and certainly Lehman Brothers until it went under, had become deeply enmeshed in the future of military government. So I think that essentially, this is just me talking and I can't prove it, but I think that what I call the American war machine is now in a position to choose among the candidates of both parties. I think that maybe they would have been happy with either Clinton or Obama. But somebody that I wanted, like Kucinich, we all know that somebody that I want to be president isn't going to make it through a single primary because the money isn't with those people. It's on the other side. They say that the biggest single source of money for Obama of any corporation was Goldman Sachs. It certainly seems to be, the behavior of the Obama towards the financial bailout was both parties, I have to say, a discriminatory bailout. Not just that they prefer bailing out bankers to bailing out people, but that they bailed out some firms and let others go under. The whole thing is horrible to look at. And I think that there's freedom for Obama to do something like health care. That's not what they're concerned about. They are concerned about the military budget. And the Tea Parties are free to fight about, complain about big government and encouraged to complain about big government as long as they don't complain about the defense budget. But you don't see what we should be seeing in this country is a powerful movement that doesn't like the present size of the defense budget, which is ruining the country. It's not just bad for us. It's bad for America's posture in the world as a whole. And that's what we should be seeing in our political system. We're not going to get to see it for a long time. Yeah. Not yet. Did I see the film Inside Job? No, I hope to. I'm waiting for my...
It's a good look at the criminalization of the financial industry and the Goldman Sachs entourage around Obama being major architects and engineers of the controlled demolition of our economy. And I was wondering, with your insight into deep politics, the transition from Bush to Obama. I know I was a little concerned that it might not be a graceful, simple transition, and it seemed that Congress had the gun to their heads to push the bailout bill, despite the fact that 95% of the American people opposed it. And there were some Congress people who said that they were threatened with martial law.
That's true.
And I have a question about that.
I will speak to that.
The common martial law, and is there another martial law which means something different within the halls of Congress?
Yes, I wrote about this, and in the course of doing so, I consulted with some lawyers, and I learned that, yes, martial law inside the Congress means something different from what it means for the public as a whole. So, to just say that would sound as if we're finessing ourselves away from the crisis. But the larger picture is that many congressmen felt that they were given no choice in that matter. Whether it was martial law A or martial law B, the fact of the matter was they were being coerced into passing a bill which was horrible and which they knew was going to be very hard to explain to constituents, which is why one of the reasons we have so many new faces in the Congress. I'm afraid I can't give you the details of the two martial laws, but it wasn't the people who threatened martial law weren't saying that the U.S. Army was going to come and invade the Senate chamber and the House chamber. No, it was a different kind of martial law.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time. Our thanks to Professor Scott, speaker on continuity of government as the state of emergency superseding our Constitution, for enlightening us today. We also thank our audience. For enlightening us on a very important subject today. We thank our audience, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.